Good morning, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
Likewise, mate. I've got a couple of listener questions, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Firstly, this is from Trevor. Trevor says, welcome back. I have read that vitamin K2 takes calcium out of your veins and puts it back into your bones. Could you ask the good Dr. Walker about it, please? That's from Trevor.
No, it's calcium. The vitamin K2 takes the calcium out of your arteries and puts it back in your bones. So you get two bangs for your buck with vitamin K2, gives you more flexible arteries and stronger bones. So it's something that I think is a good thing for most people to take. I've got a zero calcium score, but I take it myself just to keep my bones strong. So I think it's a good thing for people to take vitamin K2. And the dose is 180 micrograms a day. There's a few sprays on the market that people use that have vitamin D and vitamin K2, but the sprays don't have enough vitamin K2 in it. So take a capsule, 180 micrograms a day, highly effective stuff.
This is from Leslie. Can you please ask the good doctor? Leslie has chronic heart disease, chronic kidney disease, and a stage 4 metastatic melanoma in the top of her spine. With all the immunotherapy, she said, I've had it upsets my adrenal gland and thyroid. Now my legs feel very heavy. I try to exercise on a treadmill or a bike and pool in summer 5 days a week. She said, I'm 78 and have been in remission for 5 years. Have a steroid belly and nothing shifts it. What can I do?
The problem is if she's still on steroids, there's always going to be some buildup of fat in her tummy. And the best thing anyone can do for that is just to reduce their intake of carbohydrates and keep their exercise up as much as you can. But if you're getting very heavy legs, it's pretty hard to exercise. Now, when somebody has chronic heart disease, chronic kidney disease, and the melanoma, one of the issues that always comes up here is whether Leslie's taking a statin drug to lower her cholesterol, which she probably would be. And the problem there is that can make your leg heaviness worse. So the question is, and this is what I say to people, at the age of 78, is she going to get an enormous benefit from statins? I say probably not, and it may be causing her more harm than good. So I'd speak to her doctor about possibly having a statin holiday, go off the statin for 3 months and see if that makes her legs better. As far as the belly goes, when you get to 78 and you've been on steroids, there's not a huge amount you can do to reduce the belly fat. But certainly do the lower carb diet and also keep the exercise up. And the bergamot products I've spoken about for years can help that to some extent.
Thank you, Ross. Let's get stuck into some of the topics that we're going to cover today. We've talked about keto diets. In fact, we've talked about lots of diets before. But there is some research out that a strict keto-friendly diet for weight loss and diabetes could be doing more harm than good, Ross.
Yeah, this is a really interesting study that has been done in mice. Now, that's the first important point here, that you can't always extrapolate mice data to human data. And they fed mice two keto diets that were basically well over 90% fat, 0.3% carbohydrate, which really would be unmanageable for a human being. And the fat that they used in the first diet was a thing called Crisco, which is really mainly what we call interesterified fats, which is a bit like trans fats, but it's just a slightly different process. Still give you synthetic fats, not particularly good for you. And they found that the mice on both of these diets, first the Crisco diet and the second cocoa butter, they actually had more aging cells in their bloodstream, in their heart, in their kidneys. And they're suggesting that the keto diet in the long term may be harmful to humans. Now, I'm not saying it is or isn't. I'm just saying this particular study was not really something you could extrapolate to human data. It was also done in mice who are the age equivalent of four-year-old humans. So it really is not that relevant to adults. But a lot of the anti-keto people are going to come out and say, you see, you shouldn't be having the keto diet. Whereas what I'm saying is that I don't know whether the keto diet is good or is bad for you in the long term. And I think really if people want to follow a sensible diet, rather than going keto, paleo, vegan or whatever, the only diet that has any long-term evidence base, as you and I have said for years, is the Mediterranean-based diet, which is basically just eating natural foods, 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, and just little bits of meat, eggs, dairy, chicken, fish, nuts and olive oil. I think that's the safest diet with a strong evidence base.
We've talked about this before, but I suppose you've also always said that, you know, diets don't work.
Well, they don't. What works is having a healthy, sensible lifestyle plan, which involves sensible eating and regular exercise. And most importantly, my friend,
do you know,
I had
a conversation with someone the other day, and they said to me, it was about you and how you always sound so happy. Oh. And I said, yes, well, that's one of the big things that Ross says. You've got to be happy. You've got to make happiness part of your life. Mm. And they said to me, yeah, I know, but gee, it's so easy to say, and sometimes it's just so difficult to do.
Oh, look, I agree entirely, mate. And there's a thing called the Grant Study, which has been going on for 80 years in Harvard University, and it shows the one key to health and happiness is to have someone else in your life who loves and cares for you, who you love and care for. Now, I'm absolutely blessed that I have that, and I've been married for 47 years this year, and I worship the ground my wife walks on. And I think that that's much better for my health than my damn cholesterol levels or my blood pressure or my calcium score. The most important thing anyone can do, the most selfish thing you can do for your health is to love your partner.
It's funny. I'm 40 years this year and I'm the same as you. Worship the ground she walks on. So we're just lucky men, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's one of the major keys to happiness is to have a good, solid relationship with another human being. And look, I'm not gloating about any of this. What I am saying is that there are many people out there who are by themselves, who are very lonely, and if you can seek some support from other people, it's much more important for your health to do that than to focus on numbers in your bloodstream.
Ross, the next topic we're talking about is asthma. And in reading the notes, I was just so surprised that there are a large number of people that don't realise they actually suffer from asthma.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if you look at the Australian population, 11% or 2.7 million people out of around 25 million have asthma. And asthma is really a very, very prominent cause of disability. It's the fifth leading cause of total disease burden. So we've got to look at the management of asthma. And there is a link also between chronic asthma and cardiovascular disease, so it keeps me in a job in some ways. But also, this study out of the New England Journal of Medicine recently showed that many people are wandering around with asthma completely undiagnosed. So people getting symptoms like shortness of breath, chronic cough, producing sputum, wheezing, the whole thing, they're not even having it managed. So what they did is they compared people who were just managed by standard methods, going to the GP or turning up at accident emergency departments, compared with people who are under the care of lung specialists and also asthma management people. So they have asthma management nurses as well who teach them how to use their puffers properly, give them a long-term asthma plan. And basically those people do so much better. They have 50% less use of hospitals and on the chronic disease burden if they have proper management and a proper plan where they're monitored regularly. And also a lot of people don't realise this as well, but I talk about lifestyle all the time, the importance of lifestyle. For example, there are still asthmatics who smoke. So 100% of asthmatics who smoke will develop emphysema, which is really a disturbing statistic. Also, a lot of people aren't taught the proper ways of using exercise with asthma and also respiratory exercises as well you can do. And the big deal, which is weight. If you're carrying extra weight, that makes your asthma so much worse. So if you have asthma, I think it's worth to have an assessment with a respiratory specialist at least once to get yourself on the right track.
I had a dad that suffered from asthma and smoked, and the end result wasn't good for him.
I'm sure he ended up in emphysema.
I still remember it was a daily situation for many years where he'd go away to a quiet room and use that puffing machine, whatever they called it.
Basically, you just use the some form of a ventilator or basically a little machine over the nose that goes into a thing that pumps all the ventilator.
Okay, let's talk about these losing weight drugs. There was Novo Nordisk. Is that it? Novo Nordisk has offered the medical community a bevy of updates relating to its drugs, particularly in reference to they're talking here about weight loss drugs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the big thing is Ozempic. Everyone's heard of Ozempic, which is the new blockbuster drug for not just weight loss, but for diabetes, and now it seems for cardiovascular disease as well. And one of the things people don't realise is when you're carrying extra weight, so when you get to the obese range where BMI is over 30, when you've got abdominal obesity, it's not just abdominal fat, but that's also a marker for organ fat, including fat in the heart. So when you go into these drugs, it actually takes the fat out of the heart as well as out of your gut. And it has been shown to reduce your risk for ongoing cardiac events around 20% or so, and also markedly improves diabetes. So there's a lot of things you can do around these weight loss drugs. But Ozempic's not the only drug. And in fact, there's a new drug that's come out in the last 6 months or so called Mounjaro or tirzepatide, which is even stronger than Ozempic. And they're about to release one called CagriSema, which is a combination of Ozempic and another drug, which works even more on other pathways in the digestive process. So they're really going hell for leather to investigate these drugs for all aspects of weight loss, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And look, it's really quite sad if you think about the fact that we're now going to drugs to help us lose weight, because really losing weight is all about calories in versus calories burnt. And the reality is, mate, is that most of us eat more food than we actually need to, and that's why over many years we tend to put on weight. So the true pandemic of the 21st century is diabetes, the combination of diabetes.
How long can people take these weight loss drugs for?
That is a magnificent question, because here's the problem. No one knows. And in fact, the studies are now showing that just say you get down to your target weight. You want to lose 15 kilos. You've been on these drugs for about a year and you go, okay, I've lost the 15 kilos, I stop. There is a marked rebound in weight gain. So to use the analogy of cholesterol-lowering pills, if you start off with a cholesterol of 6 and your cholesterol goes down to 4, if you stop your pills suddenly, the cholesterol goes up to 8. And it's the same thing with these weight loss drugs. If you shed 15 kilos over 12 months, stop them suddenly, you'll whack on more than 15 kilos over the next 6 to 12 months by stopping them. So what I'm saying to people is that when you've hit your target weight, you don't stop the drug. What you do is, instead of having a weekly injection, you might have an injection once a fortnight for 3 months, then once a month for 3 months, and then stop when you've allowed your metabolism to settle back down to where it should be. So no one knows. And here's the other problem is, what are the potential long-term side effects? So, for example, I saw a guy today who's carrying far too much weight, but he's also diabetic, and he would do very well on these drugs, but he's had a thing called pancreatitis, where the pancreas gets very inflamed. And one of the side effects of being on these drugs is pancreatitis. Another less reported side effect, relatively rare, but it has been reported, is thyroid cancer in certain subgroups of people who use these drugs as well. 40% of people who use these drugs get a degree of nausea. Some people get diarrhea. Some people even get weirdly constipation. So there's a lot of side effects with these drugs. They are not miracle cures. The only miracle cure is to rearrange your lifestyle, which tragically less than 10% of the population
people
can
that
do.
Are taking these injections, do doctors tell the patients, look, you've got to change your diet. You can't just take this injection and still continue to eat all the rubbish under the sun?
Mate, you'd like to think they would, but unfortunately doctors are pretty time poor, and writing a script for someone is quicker than sitting there and having a long conversation with them about lifestyle. But I spend, I would say, 80% of my consultations with people talking to them about the vital aspects of lifestyle. I've seen about 15 people today, and I've repeated the comment 15
Daily
times.
Daily fish oil may raise the risk of heart disease in healthy people. That was the headline. I read the story, and I thought, gosh, I've been taking daily fish oil for years. Now, the gist of this is, if you don't have heart disease, you don't need to take a daily fish oil capsule. In fact, if you don't have heart disease and you are taking a fish oil capsule daily, it actually could be doing you more harm than good. Is that right?
No, it's absolute and utter nonsense. So I actually read the study, and let me say that they looked at 415,000 people, or just over 415,000 people, a thing called the UK Biobank. The UK Biobank's been going for the past 20 years, where they've looked at a whole lot of different parameters in people who've donated their blood into this biobank. And they've also looked at the physical characteristics of these people, their life habits, so some genetic profiles as well, and looked at people who have taken fish oil. And they found in the healthy people that didn't have vascular disease, there was a slight non-statistically significant increase in their risk for atrial fibrillation. But as time went on, the fish oil actually helped reduce their risk for a whole lot of other vascular events as well. And I think this study is a bunkum, to be frank with you, because I think what happens is when you actually look at the data carefully, which I've done because I'm a great advocate of people taking supplements, there's a little-known place in the UK, in the US, called the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic have done this analysis of all the fish oil studies, and they found that people who take fish oil up to 5 years have no benefit. Doesn't help them, doesn't hurt them. People who take fish oil beyond 5 years, there's about a 20% reduction in cardiovascular disease. This slight increase in atrial fibrillation, as I said, barely reaches statistical significance. And in fact, in one study where they gave them a big dose of fish oil, they said a 50% increased risk for atrial fibrillation. The risk went from, I think, something like 0.6% up to 1.2%. We're not talking about a huge increase. And in fact, there was another study called the Reducer Trial, where they used 4 grams of a purified form of omega-3, and they found in people who were heavily treated with other medications like statins, who were at very high risk for heart disease, there was a 25% reduction in further vascular events in people taking fish oil. So I think it's still good for people to take fish oil or krill oil, one of those. I think these studies don't really look at it properly. They're just really looking at what people are doing at the time. They're not following people over a long period of time who take supplements. I think that's the problem with trials like this. So that's why I wanted to mention it, to say I think it's an irresponsible trial that's been reported
Could
very
I
badly.
I understand you right. When you said with krill oil or fish oil, the benefits don't really happen or kick in until you've been taking it for 5 years?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And see, this is the problem. That if I line up 100 people and I give them any medications at all, natural or pharmaceutical, after 12 months, 50% of people have stopped. Now, in this particular analysis of the UK Biobank, they just looked at the people who were taking fish oil when they studied them. They didn't follow them up. They just followed up their events later on. They didn't ask them 10 years later, are you still taking fish oil? And I can assure you, most of the people in the trial wouldn't have continued to take them. And this is the problem with a lot of medical studies. When they just do questionnaires on people, they're not doing regular questionnaires to see whether they're still taking the therapy, doing their exercise, eating the right foods. And this is a lot, goes back to what we were saying initially about the keto diet. A lot of people go into the keto diet and they stay on it for a month or two, and they go back to their normal habit. If someone reanalyzes them 5 years later, they might have been on the keto for 2 or 3 months and eating bad food for the rest of the time. Who knows
what
that means?
Last but not least, let's talk menopause. Menopause can bring increased cholesterol levels and other heart risks, can't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is an analysis from a thing called the Framingham Heart Study, which started in the 1970s. And basically, Framingham's a city west of Boston, and they looked at the entire population of Framingham, males and females, and looked at all of their life habits, their cholesterol, and just followed them over years to see what was happening. And they found out that, and this is where we start to understand all these things, women are protected by their hormones typically until menopause, then their cardiovascular risk starts to increase. And what they found is that when women start to go through menopause, their cholesterol levels go up, the cardiovascular risk increases, as I just said. And they looked at postmenopausal women versus premenopausal women, and they found that there's double the risk for heart disease once they've gone through menopause. So what the message is here, because obviously women can't stop going through menopause, is probably a good idea to consider taking early hormone replacement therapy for most people. I wouldn't do that if you've got a strong family history of breast cancer, but if you've got if you're otherwise well and you're starting to get hot flushing or irritability or all the symptoms go with menopause, I don't have any issues with people being on low-dose hormone replacement therapy, and that may also mitigate the effects on your cholesterol, on your blood pressure, on gaining weight, and things like type 2 diabetes.
I think it's really important that women know what they can do after they've gone through menopause. What can they do to maintain their health and well-being after they've gone through menopause?
Well, it's what we talk about all the time, mate. 80% is the lifestyle. And the more people can practice those 5 Ps, no addictions, good sleep, good eating, and less of it, because most of us eat too much, 3 to 5 hours of exercise, and most importantly, happiness, that is still 80% of the management pre-menopause, post-menopause, male or female. It doesn't really matter. And then if you've got markers when you go for a checkup, of things like cholesterol abnormalities, blood pressure, risk for diabetes, those things need to be assessed and managed. And as I say all the time, males at 50, females at 60 should have coronary
males
calcium scoring.
Males at 50 and females at 60, is that right?
Yeah, you should have coronary calcium scoring, unless, of course, you might be a 50-year-old female with very high cholesterol levels. Your doctor's considering a statin, go and have a calcium score. If the calcium score is below 100, you don't need a statin.
Dr. Ross, thank you so much for joining us on a Saturday morning. We appreciate it as always. If you've got any questions for Dr. Ross, you know what to do. You just send them to us via email and Ross will answer those questions for you next weekend. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, Ross.
Thanks, mate. I'll talk to you next week.